I think one of the most important questions that every parent has is, when will my child talk? I'd like to start with that. When parents say to you, when will my child talk, what do you say to them?
First off, I want to find out what their goal is and what their greatest wish is. And it is typically, when will my child talk? And that's why they're coming to us, because I'm a speech language pathologist, and that is what we do. We help children to communicate and to talk.
Hi, I'm Dr. Richard Solomon. Most people call me Dr. Rick. I'm a developmental and behavioral pediatrician, and for more than 25 years, I have worked with thousands of children on the autism spectrum. I've also worked extensively with their parents to help them build joyful, meaningful connections with their child. In all these years of work, my clinical practice has really exposed me to the full life course of autism, all the phases, stages, ups and downs, the turning points, and the joyful breakthroughs that happen along the way. In this podcast, I share my insights, but more importantly, I interview and invite the families, parents, siblings, and those children and young adults with autism to share their amazing insights and how they've navigated the stages of their journeys. These interviews are touching, deep, and authentic. The families really tell it like it is. Throughout each of the episodes, we hope to give you resources and practical advice so that your child or young adult with autism can grow, can make progress, and reach a level of development that is their potential, whatever that may be. Welcome to Autism, 10 Lessons for the Course of Life with me, Dr. Rick. The voice you heard at the opening is that of Dr. Cheryl Rosen, who's a dear friend and a PhD speech and language pathologist who's in private practice at Palm Beach Speech and OT Specialists in Florida. And she is my guest for episode 3, When Will My Child Talk? Interaction, Imagination, and Emotion, Oh My. And we'll be talking with her in just a few minutes. Before we dive in, I just wanted to make a note about language and the way I will talk about autism. Generally speaking, I'm a person-first language user, meaning I'm accustomed to talking about children with autism as opposed to autistic children. That's because I think of the child as a person first and having autism next, and I'm not completely comfortable yet titling people by their condition, but some people prefer to be referred to or titled this way as autistic. So you will hear me use both of these terms where appropriate, and I support you choosing your own language for this, whatever feels right for you. So I'd like to invite my guest, Cheryl Rosen, today to episode 3 of the podcast, When Will My Child Talk? Interaction, Imagination, and Emotion, Oh My. Cheryl's a good buddy of mine who's been really dedicating her whole life to the care of children with autism, even beginning with her PhD, where she studied autism as part of her PhD program. Cheryl has actually brought the Play Project model to speech and language pathologists through ASHA. That's the American Speech Language Hearing Association, and has helped the speech and language therapists understand our play-based model for helping children with autism improve in their language. And one of her big claims to fame is that she single-handedly introduced the Play Project approach to the island nation of St. Kitts and Nevis, their sister island. And you work directly with the Ministry of Health and Education, if I recall. So these are government-funded services free to children with autism and their families across both islands. And that's still happening, right?
Yes, it is.
And growing.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazing program that is just so heartwarming and bucket-filling, and I love it.
Yeah. I'm just so happy to have you here. I have the greatest respect for what you've done in the world and how dedicated you are. I think one of the most important questions that every parent has is, you know, when will my child talk? And so I'd like to start with that. When parents say to you, I'm sure you get this, you know, all the time, when will my child talk? What do you say to them?
Yeah, well, thank you first off for having me. I'm excited to talk about this because this is really something that I do in my everyday practice. I have a private practice where I meet with families every day, and these are children who are newly diagnosed with autism or who are somewhere on the spectrum and have been being treated for years, either with me or somewhere else. So when they do come and they are interested in our services, first off, I want to find out what their goal is and what their greatest wish is. And it is typically, when will my child talk? And that's why they're coming to us, because I'm a speech language pathologist. And that is, you know, what we do. We help children to communicate and to talk. So I am a play project provider and consultant and trainer. So I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I absolutely love it. It's one of the best approaches out there to helping children to communicate from a very functional perspective. And so that is the first thing that I discuss with parents, is helping them to understand what the methods and principles are of the intervention that I'm going to use, because that answers the question, when will my child talk? Because we are going to follow that child from their individual profile. So I'm going to profile them based on their functional development. And that really dictates when the child will talk, because I have to know where that child is at and really meet them where they're at, instead of trying to force speech or language on the child when they're not really ready for that yet. So there's some milestones that have to be met, and there's a very, you know, specific systematic way to get there.
So what you're referring to are the Greenspan levels that we've been talking about in this podcast, the functional developmental milestones of Greenspan that define the progression, so to speak, of all children's development. But for children with autism, you got to start where they're at.
Exactly. You're right. And so that's what I do, is kind of lay out those foundational skills and that developmental ladder that was created by Greenspan, because it is very effective in helping children to communicate and really to develop some of the core foundational skills that they will need in order to talk.
So what I hear you saying, and I also, what I try to convince parents of, is that children will talk when those foundational levels are established. Is that generally true? Would you say that the first four levels of Greenspan, which is level one, which is just simply sharing attention, just being able to share attention like a baby. And then the second level is being engaged. This doesn't involve language. Children don't talk till they're older, so they have to get this shared attention, then engagement, then back and forth, two-way communication, and then a more complex two-way communication, which in typically developing children or neurotypical children happens, you know, around 12 to 18 months or so. And so there is this natural developmental progression. So the question I have for you is, if in your experience, your vast experience, you can nurture these lower levels, which tend to be nonverbal, then when they hit level four, 3 to 4, do they start to talk?
Yes, they do, for the most part. And, you know, I say that as a caveat to, in case there is, you know, something else, comorbid kind of condition such as apraxia, and, you know, we can talk more about that later. But for the most part, yes, they will. And as you laid out those levels, you know, those are critical to having a successful communication interaction. So if you aren't sharing attention with somebody, right, and you're not engaged and relating to that person, then you're not really going to have that back and forth interaction. There's not going to be that quality or that robust reciprocal back and forth that we want to see, because that's what communication is all about. It doesn't exist in a vacuum, and it's not scripted to the point where it's just imitative. It's spontaneous and it's natural, and we have to have those foundational skills in order to get there. So when we work with children, we see that we have to sometimes go backwards to get those things. That's, because some children will come to us from another experience or another kind of traditional speech and language therapy, which focuses from a top-down approach versus a bottom-up approach. And then the child is learning this very impoverished type of language that doesn't have a lot of context or meaning to it. And that isn't, you know, true communication.
So what I'm hearing you say is that a bottom-up approach, which is a more naturalistic developmental approach, that starts with getting the kids connected socially. That's what I find, is that interaction, imagination, and emotion, this is the interaction part. If you're not connected socially, then you can't make sense of the world. You mentioned the difference between a bottom-up and a top-down. This is definitely a bottom-up approach we call climbing the language mountain. You got to start at the bottom of the mountain, and you got to climb up. But the problem, I think, is that a lot of parents want speech. They want language. They want words. What do you say to parents when they first come in, or when their face drops and they go, what? You know, I have to work on interaction? No, I want words. How do you deal with that?
That is a little bit of a tricky situation because that is, you know, their biggest wish. And so I try to explain to them, listen, that's my wish too. I want them to talk. I want them to use communication, but we have to start at this point right here so that in the future, their communication will be meaningful and it will have quality to it. And so I have to convince them of that first off and really talking to them about, you know, when your child is using these scripted phrases or these things that they're using right now, you know, are they actually interacting with you? Are they talking to you? And when they really examine the types of interactions that the children are using, they realize that no, they're not communicating to me. They're communicating sort of over by themselves or walking around just saying things that maybe they've heard, you know, from a movie or something like that, but it's not true communication. And so once they really understand that and I show them and I demonstrate some of the methods and principles of interaction, of shared attention, of engagement, and they see that their child is now coming to seek them out for interaction versus avoiding them, they buy in pretty quickly and they start to change their perspective of how communication and language should be taught versus the way that they may have been taught in the past or their ideas of how their child communicates and changing their perspective on it and understanding that this will help them get to a more purposeful place in the future.
So how long does this process take? I mean, a parent's going to want to know, like, is this going to be years? The other thing is, like, my child's already 4 or 5 and they're not talking yet. Doesn't the age matter? You know, so these are like the very typical questions. So how long does it take? Well, I know it's individualized, but is it months or is it years?
It could be either or. So sometimes it's very magical and children move up that functional developmental ladder really quickly because they start to really have fun with it. The children are having fun and they're really connected to the person who they're talking with. So that is the motivation then for them to want to communicate more and more. And then the parents feel that connection and then they're having fun. And so hopefully, you know, that change will happen rather quickly, especially in early intervention. You know, when the child is younger and there's so much neuroplasticity and malleability to their brain.
The earlier, the better.
Yeah. The earlier that we're doing this, the better the outcomes are. But sometimes it can take a long time. And that's what I have to really help parents understand is that patience is a virtue here. You know, this is definitely a marathon, not a sprint. And we will get there, but we can't rush this,
yeah.
You know, because then it might affect the overall outcomes, though. So we don't want to jeopardize that and, you know, risk the cost of providing good language by using a different model.
Yeah, that's what I say. There are slow movers, medium movers, and fast movers, but they're all movers. I like to say that there's no way around the Greenspan levels. If you want to truly be a functional communicator, you got to get through level 1 shared attention, level 2 engagement, level 3 two-way communication, level 4 complex two-way communication until you get to level 5, which is where now you're starting to use words more consistently. You've got phrase speech, and now you're actually finally talking. But it takes those levels to get there. So age doesn't really matter that much. Movement happens, in my experience, the large majority of children make good, steady progress, you know, fairly quickly. There are some children who take a longer time to get up the Greenspan levels, but they eventually do. If you keep at it, that's where patience and persistence really matters. Can we talk a little bit then about level 4? I consider that to be, I don't know whether you consider it to also be like that critical turning point when it comes to language.
Yeah, this one children will have phrase speech and they really have some problem solving abilities. So they use their language appropriately to solve problems. And, you know, they're more regulated, their moods are more regulated. So they're really changing in a sense where that shift happens. And then you can be more structured in the sense of teaching them things that is the idea. They're more ready for language learning in a different way, because we've worked really hard to build those foundational skills, which are just the key to unlocking their potential.
I've often said that when kids get to level 4, which is when they can follow one-step commands, you know, to go get things or bring things or spontaneous one-step commands, they understand what you're asking, then they're much more liable to benefit from more formal speech and language or even ABA. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that at that point, they understand that they know how to have a relationship with somebody. Mm-hmm. They know how to have back and forth interaction. So more structured teaching is possible at that time. I still think there's a lot for them to learn, you know, and they still need to move up those functional developmental levels because the next levels are more complex and really deal with more imagination and pretend play and all those types of emotional thinking aspects, which are great for their overall development as well. So we want to continue to build on those skills, and combination of both is great. And that's the first time I would really try to introduce something more structured would be once they hit level four. Because they really understand now what the purpose is and that there's a task at hand because they've built those skills along the way.
Their receptive language has really improved a lot. And the other thing that begins to happen at level four is the early imitative pretend. So they're actually starting to use their imagination. There are very few interventions that actually consider the imagination, this precious capacity of human beings, more than the Greenspan framework. And I think in our work, I'm always promoting imagination, pretend play, imagining the future, reimagining the past, reconstructing, imagining what other people are thinking. And this all starts in a rudimentary form in level four and then goes on. I'd be curious to know how a speech and language pathology approach to imagination, you know, what you do to promote that between levels four and five, things really start to take off. How do you promote imagination?
Yeah. So we do lots of fun pretend play. We have different characters and different themes and really based on what the child's interest is, which is what I love about the play project model as well is, you know, what are they interested in? What do they like to pretend and talk about? And so we just jump right into that imaginary world. So if it's, you know, Mario or, you know, superheroes or
trains.
Yeah, that's a big one. Whatever they like, you know, we'll just go with it. And then that way we join them in that and we just start to expand on that play and adding in more characters or, you know, different places that you can go and different emotional themes, you know, your guy's getting hurt or your guy's really scared to go up the hill of the train because it's so steep and, you know, and we work through some of those things through pretend plays, the different emotions and just so many beautiful things that can come out of pretend play that generalize really into other skill sets. And parents will tell me, you know, wow, you know, I saw that you guys were practicing this or playing with this. And then he came home and he was, you know, telling me how he was feeling. And so that is an incredible thing to be able to learn about your own emotions and how other people are feeling through this imaginary play.
It leads, right? Imagination leads to emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I could always tell when a child was really getting into level four or five, when you bring out a hand puppet, you know, big mouth hand puppet, and you go, I'm hungry. And they understand what hunger means. And I have pretend food and give me some food, you know, and they give the food and I go, oh, yuck. And I spit it out. You know, I spit the food out.
Yeah.
And if they love that, if they love it.
They do.
Then,
yeah, right,
yeah,
for sure.
Then and that's, you know.
Exciting. We keep talking over each other because we're so excited about this. But yeah, I mean, and that's the difference I wanted to say between the level one child and, or even just like more of a top-down approach when somebody tries to do that and they're trying to do this cause and effect type of game that doesn't make sense to the child. And between us building the levels and getting there, and then the child understands that they're feeding in this very pretend way versus just like, oh, just stick it in. And now it's this cause and effect game versus, oh, the puppet doesn't like it. He thinks it's yucky and he doesn't want to eat it anymore because, you know, he just is annoyed or, you know, frustrated with what the foods you're giving him. And they really understand that versus doing that when you're not at that developmental level. And you can really see the difference.
Stanley Greenspan and I were friends and he used to talk a lot about this process of wooing. You introduce something that you think will be fun, and if the child's ready for it, they'll go, yeah, I love that. So the train that talks or the trains that crash and like slapstick, you know, is kind of like an early form of pretending to be hurt, like hitting people with pillows. And personally, I love sword fighting, you know, but some parents don't like weapons.
Right. Yeah, they can be dangerous. But it's just pretend, right? So we're teaching children about imagination. It's pretend.
That's right. I think it's important to understand the difference between pretend hurt and real hurt.
Yeah, that is good for them.
Right. So as the child begins to develop level 4 or 5 capacities, they actually find that stuff fun. That's mm-hmm. real fun when the, I call it everything come alive. You know, it's just like it's a salt shaker. It goes, here I come. I'm going to put salt on you. You know, they go, no, no, don't put salt on me. And they get it that when they're ready.
No. I mean, it's fun all along, but that's when the fun really comes in for the parents because they've done the work. They've really done everything that they've needed to do to get their child there, and they can just enjoy playing with their child in these really fun, creative ways.
Yeah. If the parent's having fun and the child's having fun, then you're doing it the right way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So at level 5, you've got this simple pretend play. How do you coach your therapist to then help the child to move up? Because at level 5, you do start dealing with emotions. So you got interaction, mm-hmm. imagination, and emotions. Oh, my. How do you promote that within your office practice for your therapist to go from level 5 feelings to level 6 feelings? Because now we're really getting into very high level stuff.
Yeah. I mean, my practice, fortunately, is because I really enjoy this developmental type of therapy. All my therapists are trained to interact and to teach in that way. So we're very neuroaffirming. You know, we are strength-based. So we are really helping parents to work with their child based on that, and same with my therapist. So there's other means that we can use as well. You know, we will always use play first, but because level 6 changes and sort of shifts into now, not just the egocentric way, but to be able to think about other people's perspective as well, we'll use some things like social stories or like bibliotherapy, where there's different characters and themes again, but something that's a little bit more relatable to their own experiences. If they're having some difficulty, maybe at school or with friendships or things like that, we'll bring in some of these theme-based social stories that help them to understand what could happen wow. or, you know, what they could say or what they could do in those specific settings.
Wow, that's amazing for kids on the spectrum. So level 5, just to go back a quick second, is called shared meanings. That's when you start to understand the meaning of simple WH questions like what, where, and who.
Right.
And so you do understand what people are saying receptively, and you're beginning to express yourself in longer phrases. But when you get to level 6, you're really dealing with the why and the when. And I always give the 2 milestones. I'd be interested to hear your comments about this. But the 2 milestones that I talk about for level 6 is recalling the past. What did you have for breakfast? And answering the question, what do you do when you're hungry? And if they say eat, now they're connecting 2 ideas. So I like to use that for parents. It gives parents this very clear idea that, oh yeah, my child is developing a memory for the past. They can actually recollect, recreate, and answer questions. What did you have for lunch? And they can also begin to connect 2 ideas together logically. And kind of what you're saying then is you take advantage of that to actually begin to address social emotional issues.
Yeah. And from that framework that you're explaining too, it also helps parents to understand when their child will be at those levels, because a lot of times they'll try to ask their child, you know, what did you do in school today? And they can't answer it if they're not at that level yet. So it really helps them to have a framework to understand, well, that's why they're not answering me. And parents will always say, you know, I just don't understand. They can't recall the past. They're not telling me what they're doing. And then when we break it down and we look at that functional developmental ladder and each level and what skill set you really gain in each one of those, it helps them to know where they should be communicating or what questions they should ask their children at that point, which I really love about the framework too, because, you know, they'll be asking them WH questions when their child is at a level 1, when they're really, you know, still working at level 1, try to get them to share attention and be self-regulated enough to engage with us. And they're trying to ask them, you know, who, what, and where questions, and the child is not responding, and then they're getting frustrated. But when they understand the framework, it really helps them to know, okay, I don't need to ask so many questions right now. I just need to be with my child, and I just need to comment or, you know, to narrate what they're doing so that I can connect with them in that way versus, you know, drilling and skilling them when they're just not there yet.
That's a great point. And I think for parents listening to this, it's very important to understand what Cheryl's referencing there. I call it backfilling. In other words, you're always paying attention to attention. You're always paying attention to the child's intention. You're always thinking about the interaction back and forth, the interactional process back and forth. These are the first three Greenspan levels. We're always backfilling those levels so that the child becomes what we call, quote, more solid at the lower levels so that they begin to really climb up that language mountain, that ladder, and get to the point where they can truly function at level 5 and 6. Now they've gained the solid social ability to be with somebody in a true relationship. And then that generates pretend, that generates relationships, that generates emotions that the child then has to grapple with. It becomes a lot more complex. Once you get to level 5, 6, then the parents can say, what did you do at school today? And the child will understand that question. They'll have made sense of the past and they can say, played on the playground. You say, who did you play with?
Yeah, and it's spontaneous. So it's not scripted and where they're giving them a sentence completion task. I did this. You know, this is natural. The child has a memory. They're recalling the past and telling you about their experience, which is what we really would love to see. And we want that child to be able to do with us on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. It's natural and it doesn't have to be prompted. And the child wants to have a relationship.
Yeah, and wants to communicate with you about their day.
Let me ask you about something that I've become more aware of is what's called gestalt language learning, where kids learn from scripts that they hear. They're using chunks of language that kind of creates an opportunity for language. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of language?
Mm-hmm. There are chunks of language that they've heard or that they've learned, but they really like it. So it's really motivating to them. And then they'll take that and apply it to something else. So, you know, it could be that they're saying, don't throw my blanket off the balcony. And, you know, you're thinking, what does that have to do with anything? But that could be a way for them to be communicating to you about something that they didn't like.
Right.
So, because at one point, you know, they were maybe outside on the balcony and they were about to throw their blanket off and the parent went, oh, don't throw your blanket off the balcony. And so the child knew like, oh, that's not something I'm supposed to do. So then there's something they don't like or they're not supposed to do. And they'll say, don't throw your blanket off the balcony. And so that's a gestalt or a script that they learned to actually try to communicate to you about how they're feeling or that, you know, something that's going to happen that shouldn't happen. So we would want to join them in that.
But you would also say to them, oh, you don't want me to do that, which would be the more naturalistic language, right? You would mirror their feelings.
Yes.
In more naturalistic language, you would accept their gestalt expression, but then you would respond back by recognizing their feelings and giving that back to them. I call that mirroring. You know, that's a really important technique for promoting emotions is to mirror back to the child their feelings in words. And you would say something like, oh, you did not like that. And then they'll nod their head and kind of confirm that.
Yeah. So this has existed really even since the beginning of our field in the 70s and 80s. Gestalt language processing was pretty big. And then, I don't know, it kind of went down underneath for a little while. And it's just resurfacing. A lot of new research has come up on this. So what they're seeing is that, you know, especially children with autism will communicate in these just gestalts where they have scripted language, but there's meaning to it. And so it isn't nonsense. You know, there are things that they are communicating through this scripted language. And that can make it a little bit tricky for our parents because it isn't as functional as we would like it to be. And so that's the reason why we want to go backwards and, you know, start to fill in these holes, like you said, backfilling, because we can use those scripts as motivation and as interest, but we can still go backwards and help to produce the shared attention and the engagement and the two-way communication if we use those gestalts. So we use those in a positive way. So we don't disregard them. We say, okay, this is what the child's motivated to talk about. This is what the child's interested in. So if we can join them in that, we can use that as a way to get in to then build the skills up the functional developmental ladder. That's just one part of it. There's a whole other part of it that we can talk about that has to do with augmentative communication. But in this sense, you know, that's what I would say about using gestalts in positive ways. So instead of ignoring that or saying, oh, that's just, you know, some script that doesn't mean anything, we'll attach meaning to it and then mirror what they are feeling and being able to then, you know, help connect to them because then they're going to look at you like, yeah, you understand me. You know what I was trying to say there. And so that builds that relationship and that connection even further.
So let's finish up by talking about augmentative communication. So let's say the child appears to have very good receptive language, but their expressive language. So this is my definition. I mean, I'd be interested to hear your perspective, but my definition of dyspraxia or apraxia is that the child's receptive language is greater than their expressive language. They should be talking because they understand so much, but then they're not talking. And so I consider that a form of dyspraxia. And that's when I begin to think about augmentative communication. Is that consistent with your view?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, we've done all the great work. We've built the building blocks to communication, and the child, you know, still just isn't using verbal output, verbal communication. So we have to then do some differential diagnoses and figure out why is that happening. Potentially, it could be that they have verbal apraxia or dyspraxia, which is really a motor planning difficulty. So they're having difficulty getting the message from the brain to their mouth. And so they know what they want to say. They understand what's being said to them, but they just can't produce the verbal speech on command. So that's when it's time to possibly step in and use some augmentative or alternative communication and help them to be able then to communicate more effectively because they have things that they can say and they understand that back and forth interaction. They've built the blocks to get there. And so it's a good time, again, you know, once they're about at level four, to really introduce augmentative communication to them, just like we would if we were working on modeling language or having them communicate with us verbally. And so that's where a lot of stuff is happening with Gestalt language as well, too, because, you know, we learn to teach children using a very generative approach to language, single words, just like children develop language naturally. First, you have single words, then you have phrases and things like that. So now the combination of using gestalts or these scripted phrases in addition to generative language is a really good way to teach communication because those scripts are going to be something that they've probably, even if they're apraxic, have popped out here or there, because that's the interesting thing about apraxia is sometimes you can talk and sometimes you can't. So if you've heard a script and it's running through your head, you may be able to pop that out without much effort. But if I'm trying to teach you, you know, to use a generative approach to language, first this word, then that word, it might be a little bit more challenging to do. So we want to use a combination of those in our augmentative and alternative communication approaches.
Yeah. So that's AAC.
Mm-hmm.
What does that stand for?
Alternative and augmentative communication.
I see. One of the things that I just, you know, as a developmental pediatrician, I don't do this. I see kids who do have devices. But one of the things I think I've learned is that you got to really know what you're doing to do an AAC device. A lot of parents go, well, you know, I want my kid to use, you know, the machine to communicate. I have found that you really have to find a SLP who really knows what they're doing.
Yeah, that's 100% correct.
Okay.
There is a skill set to it. Yes, you have to be trained in the different methods. And just like any other approach to treatment, you have to know the differences of how to teach AAC appropriately and how to use the devices and how to program them and how to use the appropriate number of symbols and the visual supports that you're going to use. And yeah, it is a very systematic approach to teaching AAC. And so you want to make sure that you're working with somebody who understands that and who's been trained in that area.
One of the things that I recommend, and I'd really love your opinion on this, is instead of like starting off with this sophisticated and expensive device that's electronic, to actually use like one of those little books with a Velcro strip, and you have objects that you can use of little images like icons, and put it on the Velcro strip. Like, you know, you got food, you got people, you got places, you got activities, each page, and the child can actually go there when they want to communicate to you. I want an apple. They take the apple off the Velcro strip and they give it to you. Is that kind of a primitive AAC approach that can be effective?
Well, so what you're speaking about is there's, you know, different levels of AAC. So there's no tech, which would be that. There's low tech, and then there's high tech.
Ah, okay.
And so no tech would be the pictures, which is like a PEX system, which is a picture exchange communication system, which has been around for a really long time as well. And, you know, it can be effective, definitely. Really, at this point, we expose a child to a variety of different ways. We want it to be multimodality. So some kids will respond better with pictures. Some kids will respond better with technology. Some kids will respond better to the mid type of technology where it's just a single button switch where they're just pressing it for a pre-recorded message. So there is really no hierarchy in how we teach AAC or how we use AAC, but yes, you know, visuals can be very effective for the early communicator, especially if they are having apraxia, because, you know, they just can't do it on command. So it's a lot easier for them to just, you know, pick up a picture or to touch something for them to communicate versus them trying to motor plan and get it out of their mouth. But, you know, at this point in where we are in the world and, you know, what we've experienced over time using lots of different AAC, there really isn't just like one specific type that we would recommend. It's just, it's like the play project. It's individualized and okay. It's based on what is the person's interest level. Because I've tried some picture-based systems with some children and they're not responsive at all. And then I've tried a very high-tech system, but just limiting the amount of symbols per page. And then they're very responsive to it because they like that type of visual. And so then that works well. So we just have to be open to trying different things.
That's really good. I think of the original, the earliest form of augmentative communication is gestures. We haven't really talked about gestures, but I want to end on that and just say, parents, pay attention to your child's gestures, honor your child's gestures, label your child's gestures. One of the main ways that we promote verbal language is by putting words on a child's gesture.
Yes, exactly. And that's part of level three that we didn't really get so much into the functional developmental level three, but it's super important. And that's something I emphasize with my parents all the time too, is, you know, don't ignore their gestures because that is their main way of communication right now. And it's so important for their development. And so a lot of times parents will just say, well, say this, say that, and just completely ignore that they're using the gestures. And at that point, you know, the child's getting super frustrated because they are communicating with the parent and the parent's pretending that it's not happening. And so I want to stop them right there and say, well, no, you know, he's really telling you what he wants there. And we need to acknowledge that, because if we don't, we're going to start to impoverish their communication. And then they're not going to communicate with you at all because you just don't understand them.
I know, that's my joke. The kid's reaching for juice, you know, and the parent goes, what do you want? And it's like obvious what they want. You're denying what their intent is. You go, what do you want? Say juice. Say juice. I go, how would you like it? You walk up to your spouse, you know, you purse your lips, you lean forward, and your spouse says, what do you want? Say kiss. it's like, how would you like it?
Right.
Honor their gestures. They're very meaningful. And it never ends. Gestural communication is...
Yeah, we do it every day.
Every day, all the time, very sophisticated. We're always reading each other's gestures constantly to understand what you're thinking, what you're intending. Well, listen, Cheryl, that was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for all your insights and your discussion. And I think, you know, really teaching parents how to climb that language mountain, climb that ladder of development and naturalistic language acquisition. I really appreciate all your time and your expertise.
You're welcome. I appreciate having me. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, everybody. So that concludes episode 3, When Will My Child Talk? Interaction, Imagination, and Emotion. Oh, my. With my guest, Cheryl Rosen. Thanks again to Cheryl. That was wonderful. Just to summarize, I think the main message from today's talk was that you have to establish the foundation of language capacity by focusing on shared attention, engagement, and two-way interaction by joining your child in a way that's fun so that if you do what they love, they will love to be with you. Then once you have that social connection, they will begin to climb the language mountain and move toward single word utterances, then phrase speech, and eventually develop sentences and the capacity for high level interaction, imagination, and emotion, leading to true emotional intelligence. I think one of the things that stood out for me today in conversation with Cheryl is that once this process gets going, it happens spontaneously and children develop naturally and organically like a flower unfolding to reach the potential of true flowering of language ability, which ends up hopefully in social skills and abilities. And that natural language process is magical and leads on to the future of rich emotional thinking and development. This episode of Autism, 10 Lessons for the Course of Life, was produced by me, Dr. Richard Solomon, with Jackie Malash at the Ann Arbor District Library, series consulting and editorial support from Juliet Heinle at the Listen Inn. Special thanks to Cheryl Rosen for talking with us about language development. As always, you can find all the resources I've mentioned in the show notes or at playproject.org. Stay tuned for episode 4, Please Delay Kindergarten. We'll see you then. Play on.